It's Friday, August 27th. I'm Stephen Fee, and this is The Pen Pod, a podcast from Pen America. On today's edition, chaos and tragedy in Afghanistan. A week of tumult, thousands are evacuated from the country, but many more are left behind. Risks of retaliation now threaten a vast cross-section of the population, and social media may be providing the Taliban with information they need to persecute. In an in-depth conversation, Pen America's Matt Bailey walks us through how digital platforms have lulled us into a false sense of safety and how they can reform. I'm Stephen Fee. All that coming up on the Pen Pod. This week, fatal bombings in Afghanistan and a chaotic withdrawal all reached a critical phase. Thousands have been flown out of the country, but countless more are left behind, many of whom have left a digital trail of breadcrumbs that, while innocuous before, might mean retaliation now from the Taliban. To walk us through the digital dilemma facing Afghanistan right now, our own Matt Bailey, Digital Freedom Program Director here at Pen America. Welcome back to the Pen Pod, Matt.
Hi, Stephen. It's great to be here.
Yeah. So, Matt, I want to talk specifically about Afghanistan, but first, you know, help us understand, you know, platforms like Facebook and Twitter, they're built to encourage us to share a lot of stuff, leave behind all this information about ourselves on their platforms. How are they set up this way and why?
Yeah. And, you know, I think it's important, like, before we dive into some of the terrible things that are happening in Afghanistan, that to talk about the fact that people find social media really valuable and compelling. So these tools have emerged and become so central to our lives and the lives of kind of anybody with enough of an internet connection around the world, because people are using them to do all the things that they market themselves for. They're, you know, finding friends, staying in touch with family members, keeping abreast of what's happening in larger communities that they're a part of that they would never be able to keep up with in their day-to-day before all of these tools existed. And of course, people are using it for everything from, you know, keeping track of their communities, keeping in touch with one another, to artistic expression, to documenting their day-to-day lives. I mean, a lot of us take photos or, you know, essentially like treat our posts like what would have been a diary in another age. So, you know, these platforms exist, you know, at one level as this incredibly powerful tool for engagement and connection with our local communities and with the global community. But there's, you know, there's a fundamental kind of profitability issue here. So if you talk about Facebook, if you talk about Google, and in particular YouTube, which is owned by Google, if you talk about Twitter, the other Facebook properties, Instagram, and so on, what you're talking about in essence are social media tools that are actually underwritten by an advertising business model. So when I scroll through and I'm looking at all of these posts from my friends with their babies or their bands or whatever it is on Instagram, I see all those ads for shoes or backpacks or skateboards, whatever it is that they think I want in between. And what that represents is that Instagram, Facebook by extension, is actually in the business of selling ads and targeting them to me as a person. So there's a scholar out there, activist, who's associated with Harvard Business School named Shoshana Zuboff, who's written this giant, in my opinion, profound doorstop of a book called Surveillance Capitalism. And what Zuboff does is really lays this out. What's the feedback loop between the ways that we post and engage online with our friends, with our families, with our communities, and the way that those ads arrive at our doorstop? I think we've all been spooked out from time to time by how accurately those are targeted. You know, every once in a while you're like, oh my God, how did Instagram know that I was hungry for Velveeta shells and cheese? Like, how did they know that my running shoes are almost worn out? What's going on here? And, you know, what Zuboff and others have documented is that what these social media platforms are doing is they're paying a whole lot of attention and increasingly sophisticated attention to everything that we're doing in order to learn as much as it possibly can about us as individuals and as communities in order to target those ads as smartly as possible. So if in the olden days and still today, advertisers would buy a billboard beside the highway trying to just literally reach as many eyeballs as possible, regardless of who's driving by, today they have increasingly sophisticated tools to say, I want to target my ad to people who are within a 5, 3, or 1 year age range, have a certain gender identity, have certain fitness or athletic lifestyles or certain hobbies, live in certain places, and so on and so forth. So this is what Zuboff calls surveillance capitalism. And, you know, it obviously, you know, we're all creeped out at one level or another by this dynamic or aware of it at a certain level. But what Zuboff does, I think, really profoundly is points out that there's a feedback loop between these two things, which is to say Facebook wants us to push as much content about ourselves and as granular and detailed of content about ourselves as possible so that they can harvest as much data about us as possible in order to target those ads. So they're in competition to surveil us more and more accurately than Google can surveil us in order to provide us more and more targeted ads that they can sell for higher prices and at greater scale to advertisers. So what all that adds up to, aside from, you know, these sort of runaway surveillance capitalist business practices, is that each of us is building a profile of ourselves just in our interactions online, anything that we post. We're building essentially a biographical sketch of ourselves in data that is being held by these companies, and then advertisements are being sold against.
So, I mean, so now let's move to the Afghan context, right? Where, you know, since 2001, you know, whatever you think of the conflict, obviously there's been a great liberalization, lots of young people in Afghanistan, a huge proportion of people who are under the age of 25, a lot of people on digital platforms who, you know, when things might have been relatively stable in a place like Kabul, you know, having a biographical sketch of yourself, as you explain, online and public might not be that big of a deal. And then suddenly that rapidly changes. So you wrote a lot about this on Penn.org this week. So explain how now all of that granular data, that biographical sketch that you've basically provided to these platforms because of this feedback loop, how is that now being weaponized against people in Afghanistan?
Yeah, and I think, you know, if you think about that business model, I mean, let's lay aside for a moment the fairly overwhelming privacy concerns and sort of business practice concerns that we might have with the whole model of surveillance capitalism.
Right.
But let's just talk about what that makes the platforms good at and what it makes them blind to. So if you have these tools that are built to develop as robust of a picture of all of us, of all of their users globally, over as long a period of time as they possibly can. So somebody like me, you know, Facebook data, either direct or interpolated from all of the other places that they get data, you know, goes back a couple decades at this point. So it makes the platforms really, really good at and heavily invested in a continuous picture of every user in a continuous identity, like a single continuous identity. So I am me, I'm not three different people. I don't contain multitudes. I am one person over time and across all of my interactions online. And it also tends to make them think in terms of individuals and networks of individuals, right? So there's me existing over time, and then I have certain relationships. Who's my mom? Who's my brother? Who's my dad? Who do I interact with professionally? And so that's fine. You know, that adds up to ads that are targeted that know that I, you know, am a runner and also like computers and that I know my brother, right? But what it makes them really, really profoundly blind to is what happens when the culture suddenly totally shifts and my relationship with my public identity online or who I'm known as having a relationship with of any kind, or what my interests might be, or my politics might be, or my gender is, suddenly shifts. So, you know, there's so many facets to this just massively tragic situation in Afghanistan right now. But what I've been thinking about a lot this week, and the piece that you mentioned that was sort of exploring, is that the Taliban, amongst a lot of other abuses, are going door to door, trying to find Westerners, trying to find anybody who's been working with the U.S. or as an ally, finding people who've been sort of politically at odds with the Taliban's worldview and political agenda and rooting them out. And one of the things they're doing is they're looking at people's phones, they're looking through people's Facebook profiles, through their Twitter profiles, and so on, and looking for signs basically that they've been engaged in activities that the guys with the guns don't approve of. So, you know, you have a situation where people have been living their lives. You know, if you're a 20-year-old in Kabul right now, you're somebody who grew up with the internet. You grew up in a much more stable environment than what's happening today. And your life is online. And so all of a sudden, all of that thorough documentation that you've been developing about yourself and that the platforms are designed to facilitate and maximize went overnight, essentially, from a boon, a way of staying connected, a way of expressing yourself, making yourself known in the world, to a massive liability.
Yeah, I mean, I want to get to the point about the sort of individual networks and how the platforms focus on that. But I mean, let's keep going down this road. I mean, so obviously now huge liability, all this information about someone, say you work for a human rights organization, you're a journalist, maybe you just have contacts with, you know, former NATO forces or US government officials, it now all becomes a liability for you. You know, you delete your profile, right? Like you delete everything. I mean, it seems like that would be sad and upsetting because you lose all your photos and all these other things. Why is that in particular, you know, this sort of choice to have to kind of delete your digital life, a free expression issue? Why do we care about this so acutely?
Yeah, and I, you know, like the examples that you're using are relevant for sure. And I think, you know, obviously people who've been, you know, working to build democracy in Afghanistan are particularly being targeted, but you could have easily added to your list, you know, instead of just are a human rights defender or an activist, you could say are a woman, right? Or right. So what you're really talking about is not a small crust of, you know, particularly politically active or radical people or people who are especially close and have been literally working in the U.S. embassy. You're actually talking about a massive swath of Afghan culture, and in particular people who've been living in the capital, who are potentially at risk, not necessarily just for political activities, but for, you know, what we would regard as like living their lives. So you're not talking about individual risk, you're talking about risk at societal scale. And people aren't dumb, you know, the scale of people who are trying to click those digital delete buttons on their lives, on their personal sort of diaries and documentation of, you know, their kids' first birthdays, as well as their art and their essays and their self-expression. That's not a small number of people. That's an extraordinary cross-section of society. It's an extraordinary number of people. So we're worried about it both because it's a tragedy when anybody has to make that decision between sort of digital self-erasure, you know, the equivalent of like burning your family photo album, and safety, but also because this really amounts to cultural erasure. It's, you know, you wouldn't want to conflate digital deletions to real world deletions or destruction, but there's a lot in common with the long-term practices of the Taliban in basically seeking to delete any type of religion, cultural expression, or identity that doesn't comport with the world that they're trying to build.
Yeah. So, I mean, in terms of grappling with this, I mean, on this one level of allowing people to somehow preserve their online identities, not suffering this kind of cultural digital erasure, also trying to react to it, not on an individual level, as you said, but that this is a huge cross-section of Afghan society. You know, what are some of the approaches you think that social media companies or digital platforms can take? Are there any steps they have taken that you're welcome to? Are there other things that we should be considering here? And moving forward, of course, I mean, Afghanistan today, another country tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we hope not, but, you know, we're experiencing this crisis, this trauma in Afghanistan today, and this is the same year that we've seen the military coup in Myanmar, just to take another example, and the continuing crisis there, the continuing silencing of culture and dissent that's happening in that country. I think that the platforms, you know, if we go back to that idea of business model and what sort of space are they trying to create on their apps and their sites, you know, that space where you're maximizing engagement, everybody sharing as much about themselves as possible all the time, has a lot of upsides. But it also means that they have a really strong interest in creating a safe place that feels safer than it is. You know, you don't walk down the street. You have the right to walk down the street saying anything you want to in many places in the world, or you know, very broad protections around it. But you're unlikely to find many people walking down the street handing out photos of their children, for example. And you know, the goal of a social media platform is to make it feel like that type of like really fulsome self-disclosure is safe, will remain safe, and you know, should really be engaged in an uninhibited manner. I would like to live in that world, but I think what we're seeing in this crisis situation is that people need better signals from the platforms about how to think about their relative level of safety, how to think about safety as something that changes over time potentially, and more complex ways of choosing who they expose what parts of their lives to. So all of that's a little bit of abstract, I think, but you know, one really positive step that we've seen really quickly, I think really admirably from Facebook is in response to this crisis that kind of models what I'm talking about is they've made one click account lockdowns available to everyone in Afghanistan. So I haven't actually used this feature myself, so I hope if anybody's amongst the listeners are more knowledgeable about it than I hope you'll forgive me. But the basic idea is if you go to Facebook today from inside of Afghanistan, you'll be greeted by a pop-up that says, hey, do you want to lock down your account? And it should be as simple as saying, yes, please lock it down right now. And that'll essentially hide away your profile, your posts, and everything else, so that if somebody demands that you unlock your phone, they can't see it. If they're trying to browse for you online, they won't be able to see it. And what's really powerful about that, and why I think that's a societal intervention as opposed to an individual intervention, is that they're pushing it to everyone within this space that's experiencing the shared crisis, and they're making it extraordinarily easy. If you're a technologist, if you're a heavy social media user, if you're somebody who's brand new to it and you've just posted your first photo and you don't really know what's going on, but you know that bad stuff's happening in your country, all of those people are getting some version of a one-click lockdown tool. I think that's profound. And we really haven't seen that type of thing. We haven't seen platforms adding panic buttons that people can use to respond to trolling and abuse if, you know, sort of folks start coming for them. And we really, really need more of that, not just when there's a total cataclysm like in Afghanistan, but for journalists, for anybody who's active, for anybody who's Black, queer, or woman online, these types of safety features are really, really needed. And they're needed at the scale of society, at the scale of the whole user base that the platforms are serving. Think of it as like safety warning labels.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, and just to round things out here, Matt, you know, you and our colleagues here at PEN America have been advocating outside of the Afghan context for things, platform design changes, product changes, ways that, you know, Facebook or Twitter or Reddit could just switch things up a little bit on the front end so that users can protect themselves from things like online abuse. And in this case, you know, shield certain elements of their data to prevent them from being at risk. I mean, this larger pathway of trying to encourage the platforms to take these steps, because the ones that you just laid out don't sound technically complex. I mean, in these companies, they're rich, they've got lots of engineers working for them. They could figure this out. You know, how do we create the incentive environment for companies like, you know, Twitter to take this challenge on and come up with these good solutions that don't require reinventing the wheel?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's an easy answer. I think that the easiest answers, you know, people reach for boycotts, people reach for regulation, you know, and these things can be appropriate in certain cases. But I think that we just really need to vocally demand these types of changes, to call out when these needs are unmet. And frankly, you know, these teams, you know, Facebook, Google, you know, these companies have sort of more money than God. But the teams that are actually trying to do the product design are usually actually relatively small. They're often fragmented And just like every other company on earth, every other organization that any of us have ever worked for, they're usually a bit under-resourced. And so, you know, it puts a lot of weight on all of us to call out where there's paradigm changes that are needed, paradigm shifts. And I think this is one of those places. The idea that these platforms through design can kind of rhetorically create what feels like a safe space is a failed one. I think people feel increasingly unsafe on social media, and that's an accurate feeling. And so I think helping the product designers, helping the leadership of these companies understand that their design, the features they're providing, are fundamentally out of touch with their users and what users demand from the marketplace is one thing that we need to do, in addition to advocating for, you know, carefully for regulation or for interventions by government or others. You know, this is a case where we have a lot of marketplace consolidation, so it's really hard to be a user on social media and not be a Facebook user in one form or another. But it is a place where the platform's a little freaked out. There's a lot of regulatory attention in the United States and Europe. And so being really vocal about what we need and what our expectations of them are, actually, this is a moment when we can collectively make a big push.
Yeah. Well, seems like you and our colleagues are doing that very thing. Matt Bailey, Pen America, you can read that piece on our website about digital surveillance and the risks that now face Afghans on pen.org. Thanks a lot, Matt.
Thanks, Stephen.
And that's our episode for Friday, August 27th. Join us next week for the Pen Pod. You can listen to all our episodes at pen.org. Follow us at Pen America on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. I'm Stephen Fee for Pen America. This is the Pen Pod. See you soon.